Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Right Stream Radio Network, and you are listening to Military Monday. I am your host, John Gresham, broadcasting from beautiful Fairfax, Virginia, where it is a lovely and balmy summer day. And you'd have a hard time believing it's August in the Mid-Atlantic, but we have had the mildest and most pleasant of summers. And with that happy thought in mind, we're going to spend an hour talking about punishment and naval discipline. Yes, folks, we're going to be talking to a man who wrote a book that literally was titled From Whips to Walls. Now, before you think I'm trying to get kinky and strange, let's talk a little bit with him and have him explain the title of his book and why the period from 1850 through the early 1920s was important from the standpoint of how you keep discipline aboard ship, especially a naval vessel, in time of war. Our guest today is U.S. Naval Institute author Rodney Watterson. He's written this book called From Whips to Walls. It is from our good friends at Naval Institute. Rod, are you out there, sir?
Yes, I am, John. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, I hope it's as nice up in Portsmouth as it is down here. I know one thing's for certain. The lobster's a whole lot cheaper up there than it is down here.
You better believe it. I've spent a lot of time in Alexandria, Virginia, and even more time in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I got to say, I prefer our weather. It's beautiful just like today, just like it is in Alexandria, I guess.
Well, I'll call you in February and see if you're still thinking that way.
Strangely enough, I like the winters too.
Oh, you're one of those. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about you. What is your background? What did you do before you started writing about such intriguing topics as naval prisons and discipline?
Well, sort of a rare breed, I guess. My background is really all technical and engineering. I was a Naval Academy graduate, did postgraduate work at MIT, and became an engineering duty officer and spent a 30-year career in the Navy, involved with the design, maintenance, and construction of submarines. So I spent a lot of time at shipyards and dealing with shipyards, and that's what brought me to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. But strangely enough, towards the end of my naval career, I realized that the books I was reading, it was never fiction. It was always historical of some sort. So when I retired from the Navy and went into a industrial career, I started taking some courses at the University of New Hampshire. And then once I retired the second time, I continued to pursue that and got a Ph.D. in history from the University of New Hampshire. So I'm an engineer that writes history right now.
And it sounds like you're one of those smart guys, being an MIT grad and all.
I don't know if I would say that was the case, but I did spend a few years there.
Excellent. Let's talk a little bit about what brought you to writing, of all things.
Well, you can't get a Ph.D. in history without writing something. So as I did that for various theses and dissertations, I did a lot of research in the archives, and I generally focused it on Portsmouth Shipyard, where I spent several tours. And then once I graduated, I just continued to pursue that research and work them into manuscripts and eventually into a couple books. So I had a lot of the research done while I was at UNH, but it took a lot more to get it into a manuscript form.
Okay, so you wrote what is probably pretty much the definitive history of the Portsmouth Shipyard, which, by the way, has had a varietal and interesting career, if you want to call it that, beginning obviously in the 1800s and continuing today as it has survived even the worst efforts of the Brack Commission over the years.
You're absolutely right, but that shipyard is really the showpiece of Seacoast, New Hampshire, and Southern Maine, and it is fiercely defended by the civilian population up here anytime there are any rumors of cutbacks or closures. It really is a prize.
All right, and does some pretty exciting work. Yet in the middle of this yard, there is a huge, by any contemporary standards that you would care to apply, there is a huge block building. And what is that building and why is it there?
You're absolutely right. The Portsmouth Prison is within the boundaries of the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, and it really commands the entrance to Portsmouth Harbor. It's a local curiosity, it's a landmark, it's a very imposing structure, and it has a most interesting history, and I was surprised to find that really very little had been written about it, and so that's what piqued my curiosity and got me initially involved with the research that eventually turned into this book, Whips to Walls.
Now, let's explain the name, because what you're actually doing is filling what was previously kind of an empty spot in historical narrative, in the sense that there's been a fair amount written about naval discipline and life during what we in the business call the Age of Fighting Sail, which was sort of before 1850. And, of course, there's been a striking amount of literature in various forms about naval discipline beginning during the Great Depression and the post-war years to today. So really what you're doing is filling in this transition period where we move from corporal punishment and shipboard confinement to a more institutionalized kind of system, correct?
That's absolutely correct. Several authors have written about discipline in the old Navy, the pre-1850 Navy, when discipline was administered through the old Navy regs, rocks and shoals, and flogging was sort of a one-size-fit-all punishment for most offensive. A fellow named James Valley wrote Rocks and Shoals, Order and Discipline in the Old Navy, and another author, Harold Langley, wrote Social Reform in the United States Navy, and both of these works really comprehensively cover life in the old Navy prior to 1850. And both of these authors mentioned the fact that when flogging was abolished in 1850, the Navy was really left with a serious discipline problem with no effective means of punishment, few punishment options to commanding officers, but it sort of dropped at that point. They had completed their intent, and so nothing was really written about discipline in the Navy after the abolishment of flogging. And then from the other end, I was particularly interested in the origins of the naval prison system because of my experience at the shipyard and having been involved with the Portsmouth prison. So thumbing through the archives, I eventually successfully filled in that void between the abolishment of flogging and the origins of the naval prison system and the early years of the Portsmouth Naval Prison.
Now, for our listeners who may not be aware, during this period before 1850, which I kind of encompass in the words the Age of Fighting Sail, shipboard life was in and of itself something of a punishment, in the sense that if you were in Great Britain, you could be drafted through something called the press gangs, which means you could be literally shanghaied away from your favorite watering hole, and the next thing you know, you're aboard a ship of the line. On the other hand, you life aboard ship. What was it like? What was life in the pre-steam world like aboard ship, day to day?
It was pretty arduous duty, to say the least. The amenities were few, and the food wasn't that good. No refrigeration, no air conditioning. It was a tough life, and the typical early 19th century sailor of the old Navy, or poor Jack as he was known, was a hard-living, heavy-drinking veteran of a lifelong association with ships in the sea. And more likely than not, he was a foreigner who, when he went ashore on liberty, was quickly victimized by thugs or prostitutes and separated from his money, requiring him to go back to sea to begin the cycle all over again. So it was a tough life, and it took a tough and rather harsh discipline system to keep a sailor like that in line and doing the things that were expected of him.
And correct me if I'm wrong, one of the few shipboard pleasures that any particular sailor of any particular Navy, including the United States Navy, might encounter was the daily rum ration, correct?
That's very true, and that was a source of a lot of the Navy's discipline problems. In fact, in the early 1830s, the Secretary of the Navy at that time, Levi Woodbury, mounted an effort to moderate the rum ration on U.S. Men of War. And what he offered the sailors increased pay if they would give up their rum ration, and it was not met very favorably. For one, the sailors liked their rum ration, but two, for very minor offenses in lieu of flogging, why a sailor could have his rum ration reduced. And I guess the sailors felt it was far better to have a rum ration that could be reduced than be faced with the possibility of flogging for a very minor offense. So rum ration was a very popular pastime in the Navy up until 1862, when it was finally abolished.
In the middle of the Civil War, no less, but we'll get to that a little later. So when you talk about enforcing discipline aboard a naval vessel, and let's try and obviously narrow it down, because we are talking in your book about the United States Navy, what would the common crimes aboard ship be that officers would have to wake up and deal with in their day?
Well, as you might suspect, the most common was drunkenness, or offenses related to drunkenness. In fact, in part of my research, I came across some studies that were conducted in the late 1840s, when they were considering the abolishment of flogging, and the Congress tasked the Navy to conduct surveys to determine the extent of flogging in the fleet and for what offenses. And one such survey in 1848 reported that 14 ships had administered 446 floggings. That was about 13 per month, of which 30% were for drunkenness, 35% were for offenses probably related to drunkenness, i.e. fighting, disobedience, insubordination, etc. And other offenses included desertion, smuggling liquor on board, gambling, stealing, etc. So there's no doubt that the abolishment of the daily grog ration in 1862 did solve a lot of the Navy's discipline problems.
Interesting. What other kinds of crimes would one run into?
Well, you could have the various serious crimes, murder, possible embezzlement, I guess, and theft, and just anything you might imagine. But, of course, the punishment for almost all these crimes was the flogging. Flogging was sort of a one-size-fits-all punishment for any crime. And for the listeners not familiar with the flogging, it was administered with a cat-of-nine-tails, and a cat of nine tails was merely a whip with 12 strands of leather, which had lead pellets embedded or tied to the end of the strands. And supposedly, the maximum number of lashes that could be awarded by a ship's captain was 12, but I found many instances where that was exceeded. And if a sailor had been convicted of a crime or an offense by a court-martial, why, he could get up to 100 lashes with the cat. For far lesser crimes, they had what they called a colt, again, which was a whip with 12 strands that merely had knots in the end of it. But needless to say, both of them hurt, and it was a constant reminder to the crew that were witnessing these lashes as to what might happen to them if they didn't toe the line.
And in many ways, these punishments, for lack of a better term, were a real part of shipboard life, culture, and society. That, as you say, when someone was punished, it was not done outside of anybody's eyes. The whole crew, the officers, the shipboard Marines who kept discipline, all watched.
Absolutely. It was a very formal type of, I don't want to say ceremony, but a procedure where all hands were assembled on deck and the punishment was very formally administered. Again, it was a constant reminder to all hands of where they might find themselves if they didn't follow the rules.
What happens in 1850 to start changing that? And I realize part of your answer is going to be technical and part of it's just going to be societal. Please explain what happened.
Well, actually, there were efforts mounted way back in the 1830s to start moderating or abolishing flogging. And in Congress, primarily the northern congressmen were most interested in doing away with it. But like you say, flogging was a very expected part of shipboard life. And the problem that the Navy had was that there was really no option to flogging. In fact, the naval officers didn't feel they had any option. In my research, I found one officer who wrote in 1840 justifying the argument for flogging, that extra labor, ordinary confinement, solitary confinement, bread and water diets are plans that do not suit well on shipboard. Solitary confinement is not practicable on board ship from the want of room. If cells were built in the hold for the purpose, they would take up space required for storage. Every man should be at all times at his post. This end would not be gained by throwing offenders into confinement. So you had this struggle between 1830 and 1840 between congressmen who wanted to abolish flogging and senior naval officers who saw no option to it. But eventually, in society, I guess the progressive movement had its roots about that time, and there was a lot of interest in helping the poor and the unfortunate, and the Navy or the congressmen were under that influence. So in 1850, why Congress did abolish the practice of flogging in the United States Navy, and as I mentioned, that that really left the Navy with some problems.
Interesting that flogging in the Navy was eliminated 15 years before slavery was.
That's about right, yes. And not only that, the Army had abolished flogging back around 1850 or so, and the British Navy didn't abolish it until around 1870 or so. But when flogging was abolished, the Navy realized they had some problems, and they had a board that was headed up by a Commodore Charles Sturt. And just let me read you two of the opinions that this board stated. With the abolishment of flogging, the board stated, We are therefore, in our opinion, without sufficient suitable penalties to enforce the discipline of the Navy. And it cannot be doubted that the law in its present shape is insufficient and unsuited the service. So the Navy discipline system was adrift, and they would not get a naval prison system until about 1890. So it was a very, it was a period of great consternation and inconsistency as far as naval punishment goes between 1850 and 1890.
Now, it's worth noting that in 1850, the Navy, as it was structured, was a very different sort of institution than we think of it today. It was tiny. I mean, we're not talking a couple hundred ships. We're talking a few dozen ships, correct?
That's absolutely right.
So it's not like the Navy was a big, big institution with anything more than a few thousand men. Yet within 10 years of this decision to eliminate flogging, our Navy, the Union Navy, goes through an exponential increase in size in just a matter of about 18 months with the start of the American Civil War, correct?
That's correct.
And this institution, which has a few thousand men, now has tens of thousands of men that are going and working everywhere from the Arctic and Antarctic circles to chasing down rebel raiders to operating on lakes and rivers and in coastal areas. And what are the great revelations as the Navy grows that we learn about discipline of this much larger and in some ways more diverse force?
Well, as you might expect, as the numbers increase greatly, so also the offenses increase greatly. And I must tell you that in my research, I went through hundreds and hundreds of ships' punishment reports, and they started with 1867. So I can only assume that the type of punishments and offenses that I was reading about in my research was an extension of what happened during the Civil War. But it appears to me that the same inconsistency of shipboard punishments existed during the Civil War as existed immediately afterwards. With the abolishment of flogging in 1862, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the Navy's discipline problems subsided, and offenses such as desertion and AWOL began to increase in frequency, and those plagued the Navy for the rest of the 19th century. In fact, desertion ran somewhere between 10% and 15% from the time of the Civil War through the early 20th century.
Did the rates of particular crimes level off or steady up during that period?
No, in my research, I really couldn't say that. The rates remained relatively constant. You may have had a slightly higher percentage of rates during the wartime, Civil War and the Spanish-American War, as you'd expect, but it wasn't huge. It was just that the giant increase in numbers in the United States Navy resulted in more offenses, more prisoners, and plagued the Navy because they did not have cells to place the prisoners.
Okay. So we go through the American Civil War, our largest conflict up to that point, and, of course, after the war, there's a drawdown. What happens to the disciplinary system throughout the 1860s and the remainder of the 19th century up until, say, prior to the Spanish-American War?
Well, during the area of no flogging and no naval prisons, that's the latter half of the 19th century, naval discipline was very inconsistently applied throughout the fleet. In fact, for most of that period, naval regulations merely suggested punishments for various offenses, and these suggestions were sporadically applied by commanding officers. And, for example, in 1867, I found evidence on one ship where the punishment for the offense of smuggling liquor on board was confinement for 48 hours in double irons, and on another ship, where the captain must have viewed the offense far more seriously, the punishment was confinement in double irons for 10 days, loss of pay for 1 month, and deprivation of shore liberty for 1 year. And similarly, drunken disorderly conduct merited double irons for 18 hours on one ship, double irons for 5 days, loss of pay for 1 month, and deprivation of shore liberty for 1 year on another ship. During that period, where the Navy did not have any options for extended confinements, either shipboard or ashore, punishments were pretty much left to the whims of the COs and the needs of the ship. And there was little doubt in my mind that a naval prison system was needed. And in fact, in the 1870s, when the Army got their Fort Leavenworth prison around 1874, the Navy mounted efforts to get their own prison, and that was denied. In the early 1870s, Congress wasn't even funding the building of ships and the funding of naval personnel, let alone funding the building of a naval prison. So they were unsuccessful at that point.
And as you say, the sentencing guidelines were non-existent at this point.
They were merely suggestions. There was nothing hard and fast that set it down, at not anything like the Uniform Code of Military Justice that eventually evolved in the 1950s. These were just suggestions for commanding officers to follow.
And, of course, to anyone who has studied naval history, one of the attractive qualities of being in command of your own ship was that once you were outside the sphere of communications in those days, you were Lord God himself aboard that ship.
You're absolutely right. And the crew was very much at the whims or mercy of their commanding officer. And throughout the latter half of the 1970s, of the 1800s, I found a lot of evidence where Secretary of the Navy and senior officers recognized that and were trying to do something about it. But really, until they had an effective naval prison system, there wasn't a whole lot that could be done.
And we're going to talk some more about that after we do a few network messages here. This is the Right Stream Radio Network, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for RightStream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. RightStream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. RightStream Tuesday with Daria Ann, Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to RightStream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guest and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the Right Stream Radio Network.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorists, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, we wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. So we owe them a lot.
We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can, but we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives. And for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. What a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And we are back on the Right Stream Radio Network. It is Military Monday, and I am your host, John Gresham, and we are talking about military discipline and prisons with Rod Watterson. Rod, are you with us again, sir?
I am, John.
Okay, well, towards the end of the 19th century, we had the rare opportunity to fight what was called a splendid little war against Spain. For very few casualties, almost no losses of materiel, the United States suddenly became an imperial power, stretching from the coast of Asia and China and the Philippines into Latin America, where we fought battles and won over Cuba and several other possessions. But along the way, we took a few prisoners. Talk a little bit about what happened to those prisoners and why it affected U.S. Navy discipline and punishment so much.
You're absolutely right, John. And just as a preface, let me say that the Navy took matters in its own hands in about 1888 and established two naval prisons, one at Boston and one at Mare Island. They sort of cobbled prisons out of existing buildings, an existing building at Boston and a marine barracks at Mare Island. So they had sort of two temporary naval prisons. But then when the Spanish-American War came along, and at the Battle of Santiago in July of 1898, we defeated the Spanish fleet. And about 2 weeks later, 1,600 Spanish prisoners showed up at Cive Island here, and the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard is on Cive Island. So there was a camp named after the Secretary of the Navy at the time, Camp Long, set up on Cive Island for these 1,600 Spanish prisoners, and also their leader, Admiral Cervera, was here for some period of time. And I was surprised to find on the pictures that you have on your website here that there are a number of pictures of those Spanish prisoners when they were at the island. But this was a very favorable incident for a POW camp. The Camp Long was set up right on the extreme edge of the Cive Island within the boundaries of the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard with the swift-flowing and tidal Piscataqua River flowing right by it. The prisoners were treated unbelievably well. It was reported that each prisoner gained an average of 10 to 15 pounds while they were here. The officers had wine with their meals. Hospitalized prisoners got flowers and cigarettes from women in the yard and in the communities. And it was reported, and even pictures were taken of Admiral Cervera walking the Portsmouth streets. So all this is to say that things went very well at Camp Long in the summer and fall of 1898. And so that set people thinking that maybe if the Navy was to get its finally get its prison, that maybe it ought to be located on Cive Island. And sure enough, in 1903, why they started to gather the funding for the prison, and then it was eventually opened in 1908. But that naval prison at Portsmouth, the castle stands right on the grounds where that Camp Long existed in 1898.
And correct me if I'm wrong, this is a very impressive prison complex for the day, very much in the mold of other maximum security prisons like Alcatraz and Atlanta.
Absolutely. I read numerous newspaper accounts during the building of the prison, and they were in awe of the size of that structure. And really, the Navy needed an awesome structure at that point. The temporary prisons that they had, especially the Boston prison, came to be known as a soft prison. People didn't even know it was there. It wasn't a very intimidating prison. And as I mentioned, at Mare Island, they had a prison that had originally been a Marine Barracks jail, and both of these prisons couldn't keep up with the growing need for cells. With the Spanish-American War, there was a bump in naval personnel, and then, of course, Teddy Roosevelt became president about that time, and he was very much interested in increasing the size of the Navy and the size of the fleet. So all of that contributed to the need for more cells.
So in other words, the increase in the size of the permanent fleet that continued up through the end of World War I helped justify the need and, by the same token, the requirement for a maximum security naval prison fairly close to where the fleet operated in those days.
That, yes, very true. And then, of course, when the First World War came around, at that point, Well, the Boston prison had been closed, and really the two major prisons were Mare Island and Portsmouth, but all of the action was on the East Coast, so Portsmouth prison just dominated all of the Navy's need for cells.
What kind of facility are we talking about, and what was life like there for the prisoners? I mean, obviously when you're inside of a maximum security prison, you are there because you are not a good human being in the eyes of society. Yet society has obviously a responsibility both to care for them, provide them medical care, feed them, provide them some labor if it can be justified, and, oh, by the way, can hopefully reform them in terms of their criminal intents. Talk a little bit about life there during this period before the end of World War I at Portsmouth.
Well, actually, life prior to World War I was in the prison was quite harsh. The confinement was subject to very small cells, and restoration really wasn't a need for the Navy at that point. So if you got to the prison, why you were pretty much there for the duration of your term. What I should say, though, is that the Navy divided their prisoners into two classes. Criminals, those that were guilty of offenses that could be tried in a civilian court, i.e., murder, embezzlement, rape, and unfortunately homosexuality at the time. And then the other class of prisoners was those guilty of military offenses, i.e., violating naval regulations, desertion, AWOL, insubordination, disobedience. And the criminals would pass through the naval prison en route to a state prison. Here in New Hampshire, it would have been the New Hampshire State Prison. In California, why it was San Quentin through Mare Island. So the really, really serious offenders, the criminals, would pass through to a state prison, and the naval prisons were pretty much dominated by those young men who had committed military offenses.
Were there ever any, obviously prisons have wardens, and Portsmouth was no exception to this rule. Were there any of the wardens who showed any signs of more modern thinking regarding reform of prisoners, or were they all pretty much hard asses?
No. Well, thank you for asking, because a good part of the book deals with a Thomas Mott Osborne, who was warden of Portsmouth Prison during the First World War. And he has a most interesting background. He came from a family of social activists who were heavily involved in anti-slavery and women's movements. And so his dedication to progressive prison reform stemmed from his family heritage. And when I say progressive prison reform, you should think open cells and prisoners governing themselves. And this Thomas Mott Osborne was a New York politician. He and Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the early 1900s, I guess, were involved with fighting Tammany Hall and some of the other battles that go on in New York politics. And then with the election of Woodrow Wilson in 1913, why Jophesus Daniels became the Secretary of the Navy. He selected FDR to be his Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and FDR convinced Jophesus Daniels that this Thomas Mott Osborne, a civilian, should be made a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy and be placed in command of the Portsmouth Naval Prison. Now, Thomas Mott Osborne was the most noted progressive prison reformer of his era, and in fact, he had been the warden at Sing Sing Prison immediately prior to coming to Portsmouth Prison. So when he arrived in the fall of 1917, why he set in motion a lot of reforms at Portsmouth Prison.
So this is a guy who had a strong resume, including the proverbial big house at Sing Sing. And how effective was he? I mean, talk a little bit about the metrics of his work during World War I.
Well, his effectiveness was in the eyes of the beholder. If the beholder was the Secretary of the Navy, Jophesus Daniels, or his assistant, FDR, they thought that he was just phenomenally successful. During his period here at the shipyard, 2.5 years, he restored over 2,500 prisoners. Now, prior to his arrival, prisoners were restored at maybe 10 or 12 a year. Now, with the World War I, the Navy had a need for restored prisoners, and Osborne more than fulfilled that need. He was very sympathetic to prisoners. He was the prisoner's champion. He didn't really care what offense the prisoner had committed before he got to Portsmouth Prison. His restoration or improved privileges would depend on his behavior and performance while at the prison. So Osborne was pretty much the czar of the prison, and he had a direct link to Jophesus Daniels and FDR for things that he wanted to do. That was the good news. He restored 2,500 prisoners. The bad news was that the fleet became very disenchanted with the marginal prisoners that were being restored to their ships. And Admiral Sims and other senior naval officers took on Jophesus Daniels for Osborne's performance at Portsmouth Prison. And eventually that resulted in him being dismissed from the prison in the spring of 1920. But the fleet, needless to say, was very unhappy with Osborne's performance at the prison. I don't want to subtract from what he did, because his experiment at the prison is recognized as one of the most ambitious experiments in progressive prison reform ever. And autobiographies have been written about him. Any penal history that you read will reference his experience at Portsmouth Prison. But there's no doubt that placing a very liberal, progressive prison reformer in a very conservative Navy, as you might expect, resulted in a number of issues and problems.
Indeed. Well, World War I ends. The Navy is drawn down, though not nearly as much as after the Civil War, and the nation experiences a relatively prosperous decade in the 1920s. And what happens during this period, both to the prisons at Mare Island and Portsmouth, as well as discipline in the Navy overall?
Well, as you might recall, during the 1920s, that was pretty much a period of disarmament and naval treaties that reduced the size of the fleet and the size of the naval personnel that were manning the fleet. And so discipline problems dropped dramatically, as a matter of fact. The number of prisons at Portsmouth Naval Prison, prisoners at Portsmouth Naval Prison and Mare Island were just a shadow of what they were during the First World War. So things dropped off dramatically until the Second World War, when, again, it increased. But I might say that there were prisoners restored during the Second World War, but nowhere near as many as this Thomas Mott Osborne restored during the First World War.
Okay, and similarly, what starts happening with the coming of the Great Depression to naval discipline? The Navy obviously is a big part of Roosevelt's New Deal program in terms of providing jobs for building warships and aircraft and such. What happens to naval discipline as we move into the Great Depression?
Well, there's as you said, there's no doubt that FDR was a great supporter of the restoration of the fleet. In fact, it was surprising to me in my research what he was able to do in the middle of the Depression in way of starting to build another fleet. So the numbers increase. The nature of the offenses that I could find were not significantly different from what we had had previously. And really, throughout the 1930s, here at Portsmouth Prison, we had very few prisoners. At one point, it got down to maybe 70 or 80 prisoners, and then it blossomed as soon as the Second World War started, and they were up to numbers like 2,500 and 3,000 again with the growth of the Navy. So actually the 1930s were not a very active period as far as naval prisons go.
We're now obviously in the 21st century, and we obviously have the Uniform Code of Military Justice providing continuity and consistency to naval law enforcement. We have an organization known very well because of the television series as the Naval Criminal Investigation Service, NCIS, which is the Naval Police Force. What has happened to Portsmouth Prison? What is it doing today?
Well, it was closed in 1973, and it still stands there commanding the entrance of the harbor. The Navy keeps trying to find tenants for the prison. The problem is that it's really inaccessible to any organization other than those that have clearances to get through the gates of the shipyard to gain access to the prison. So right now it's standing there. It would take an unbelievable amount of money to remove it, and it would take almost as much probably to remove the asbestos and the other environmental hazards that are there to convert it to some use. But as recently as the past few months, the Navy has been advertising its availability in hopes of attracting a tenant.
So it's very much a damned if you do and damned if you don't kind of structure.
Pretty much so. Still very solid. But as you can imagine, after having been closed in 1973 and not having anything done to it since then, well, it's going to need a lot of repair and upkeep before it can be put into any use.
I'm just trying to think of all of the carcinogens that are inherent to something that was closed the same year the Environmental Protection Act was passed, ranging from lead pipes and paint to asbestos and God knows what else.
You're absolutely right. The EPA would have a ball if they ever decided to open that facility again.
It wouldn't just be a Superfund site. It would be a super-duper-fund site.
Funny you should mention that, because the shipyard was very much involved with Superfund sites as a result of industrial waste disposal during the Second World War and then afterwards. They have several Superfund sites that have been cleaned up to the tune of millions of dollars, though, and the prison might be another one if they decide to open it again.
I want to thank you for sharing this intriguing hour talking about a subject that I'm sure very few of our listeners would have imagined would be as interesting as it is. What are you going to work on next? I mean, you've written a history of a shipyard and a prison system. What's next?
Well, let me just take a moment. On the first book, I think I mentioned that the first book I wrote was about the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard experience during the Second World War, the mobilization. And in fact, it was a record-setting performance. During the war, the shipyard built 79 submarines, more than any other shipyard, and they produced 32 submarines in 1944 in one calendar year. And no shipyard had ever built that many submarines before or since in one year. That was after going through a period in the 1930s where they built maybe two or three submarines a year. They were able to mobilize and build up to the production of 32 submarines in 1944. In that year, they launched three submarines simultaneously and a fourth in the same day. So they launched four submarines in one day. And that book, 32 in 44, Building the Portsmouth Submarine Fleet During World War II, is really an industrial study stemming from my engineering and technical background of how the shipyard was able to do that. I spent a number of years there as a young officer on the waterfront, hearing stories from veterans who had been there during the war, telling me of these remarkable things that had been done, and I was left wondering who were those people and how did they do it. And then sometime later, I was in need of a dissertation topic at the University of New Hampshire, and so I decided to write on that mobilization. And as I mentioned at the outset of this program, that eventually grew into the first book. So that was the first one, and then Whips to Walls was the second one. Right now, I'm working on a book that's sort of a sequel to the first one. The first one was what happened during the mobilization at the shipyard, and the one I'm working on now is what happened to the local communities around here, especially Portsmouth, as a result of the mobilization of the shipyard. And that one's going to be called, I think, Boomtown Portsmouth, the World War Transformation of a Quiet New England Seaport. So as in many communities around the country during the war, it was transformed. It had booms of population, economic booms, skilled worker booms, and Portsmouth, quiet Portsmouth, became a liberty town with a boom in bar sales and prostitution. So it was a city unlike it had ever been before, and it is still benefiting economically from having the shipyard here. And as we mentioned early on, the communities are great defenders of the shipyard, and the shipyard is really a prize that's cherished. So that's what I'm working on now, Boomtown Portsmouth.
Very good. Perhaps when you get that done, you might come back and talk to us again.
I'd be pleased to do that. Thank you very much for inviting me.
I will, and with that, we're going to call it a day. This has been an excellent show, and thank you very much for coming on, Rod.
You're very welcome. Again, I appreciate it, and I'm thankful for the invitation. Have a good day, John.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And with that, listeners, we come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. We're working next week to try and get you a show about the aircraft that have flown out in the western United States at the famous, some would say infamous, Area 51, Groom Lake Air Force Base. We'll let you know how that goes. In any case, thank you for joining us this week. Have a great week ahead, and take care.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. And he said that he's coming to me. I never loved a soldier until the walls were
was about to die. I never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my the song to a dead man to me. I never loved a soldier till there was a war. I thought about tomorrow till my baby floor. I only talk to God when somebody's about to die. Never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. You can cry for her, die for her, lay down your life for her, kiss and wave goodbye to her, anything at all. You can cry for her, die for her. There's a baby on the doorstep, wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flag to a pawn shop. Pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dear.